what?
Is there a separate seminar form for undergrads to go to, or if they want to?
There's a chemistry club now that that's been reinstituted. That's going to have some. What? It's just getting started, so I don't know that the plan is known. Yeah, I got to get started. Okay, remember this story? What's this about? Remember, it was the example of X-ray that these guys from Yale determined the structure of the ribosome and did it. Got 250 angstroms wide, and it's 100,000. Whoa! Let's back up here. I'm the only one who can see it. There we go. Thank you. Start over. Okay. Remember this? Yes. Okay. So the guys from Yale figured out the ribosome structure, 250 angstroms wide, 100,000 angstroms plus hydrogen. Do you know the news today?
Nobel Prize in chemistry.
Right, they got the Nobel Prize for it. Actually, it's shared among Tom Stites, who's in MB&B but has a joint appointment in this department, and Ramakrishnan from Cambridge and Ade Yonat from the Weizmann Institute of Science. And I bet none of you know the special distinction of Ramakrishnan. His special distinction is he's the only Nobel laureate this year who never shared a room with me. In graduate school, I roomed for a little while with Tom Stites, and when I was on sabbatical in Israel in 1980, I shared an office with Ade Yonat. So there's my touch of greatness. Okay, that's the news today, and now back to business. So we're looking at BH3 as an example of three different ways of looking at molecules. What nature does, that is how the electrons distribute in their total electron density, we looked at that last time, different layers and what we could see. And today we're going to look at how a computer looks at BH3 with its molecular orbitals, and then how we look at BH3 through hybrid atomic orbitals and pairwise overlaps to make bonds. And the course webpage has some stuff on this that will be helpful. So the computer takes this total electron density, the same total electron density, or at least its approximation of it, that nature has, but it divides it up in a special way. It divides it into delocalized molecular orbitals that go over the whole molecule. So they have nodes, and we already know this kind of stuff. So just to review, here's BH3's structure, and we're going to look at its molecular orbitals. And the particular computer program that did this did it using what's called a minimal basis set. That is, it approximates the whole molecular orbital that goes over the whole molecule by adding bits of atomic orbitals. We do it with pairs. The computer does it with the whole set. But this whole set isn't the whole set of all possible atomic orbitals. Why not? Why doesn't it use the whole set of possible atomic orbitals? Robin?
It would take too long.
How long?
Right,
they're an infinite number. So this one just used the least number you could use and hope to get something realistic, which means, so it's the minimal basis set. It uses on hydrogen, each hydrogen, a 1s orbital, that's 3. And on the boron, it uses 1s, the core orbital, but also 2s, 2px, 2py, 2pz, and that's all it uses. So it could do a better job if it used more, but it would take more time. Anyhow, let's see how it did. So there are 8 low-energy atomic orbitals in this basis set. That means you're going to be able, from those, to make 8 low-energy molecular orbitals. Low or high, whatever, from 8 you make 8. Yeah.
So it's hybridizing using all 7?
Yeah, it's essentially hybridizing, although what you call it is LCAO, a linear combination of atomic orbitals. Hybrid is used when they're both on the same atom. right? But it's the same idea. You add them up in a weighted sum. So we're going to have 8 low-energy molecular orbitals from these 8 atomic orbitals. That'll use up 100% of them. That's the end of the line as far as these go. Okay, that's how their energies come out schematically. One that's really far down. What's that one? That one, of course, there are 5 electrons that come with boron, 1 from each hydrogen. That's 8 altogether. So how many orbitals are going to be occupied? 4, right? Pairs in each of 4 orbitals. And, let's see, here we go. Okay, so there are going to be 4 occupied molecular orbitals. And there are going to be 4 unoccupied molecular orbitals. No one uses the term OMO and UMO except us. Okay, but they do use the term highest occupied molecular orbitals because that's of more interest. So there are 2 HOMOs in this case. They have the same energy. They're degenerate. And there's a single LUMO, and they use that term as well, the lowest unoccupied molecular orbital. Okay, now, so there are the occupied orbitals, and as we said, the lowest of all is 1s. It's the core orbital on boron, and who cares? Okay, so that's the boron core. And then there's the 2s orbital that has no nodes other than that little one down around the boron core. And then that one shown there with its radial node. Then there's going to be a 2px style that we've seen exactly like that before, and which in solid looks like that, and a 2py style that'll look like that. Okay, so that's the occupied orbitals. Then the next one is the 2pz, but there are no electrons to put in it. So it's the lowest unoccupied orbital. Notice it's an atomic orbital. It's not shared with the hydrogens. The others are all shared with the hydrogens. Why isn't this, except for the core orbital, why isn't this one shared with the hydrogens?
Does the hydrogen not have any electrons?
No. No, you don't care. There are no electrons to put in this altogether, right? And we have the whole basis set of those 8 orbitals to put together. Why do we have only the 2pz here? Sagar? It's orthogonal. Right, it doesn't have any overlap with any of the other orbitals. Right, so it stands alone. This 2pz is the LUMO. Now the others that are higher orbitals do mix, and they do include the hydrogen, but antibonding. That's why they're high. Okay, so there's a 3s, 3dx squared minus y squared, and the 3dxy orbital. So that's how the computer looks at it. It takes the whole basis set, however big you make it, and it mixes and matches in there with weighted sums, LCAOs, right? And then gets orbitals of increasing energy, takes out its electrons, puts them in the bottom ones, and that's it, and it can do SCF on it. This did use SCF. What about it? Well, you notice it's anti-bonding between the carbon and the blue hydrogen that's down to the right. There's a node in between the carbon and that. Also between the carbon and the one on the top left. And to the red one on the bottom left, right? So it's clearly anti-bonding. Okay, now we do it differently from a computer because our brains aren't good at dealing with this big basis set and doing linear combinations and optimizing everything. But we can think about it, which a computer can't, right? And get insight into why things are the way they are. So we partition exactly the same total electron density, the same one that we looked at first in the molecule and then with the computer. We do it by looking locally at different things, at an atom pair that makes a bond here, an atom pair that makes a bond here, and at lone pairs, and also at antibonds if we're interested in vacant orbitals. Okay, so we do it the way Lewis did it, looking at shared pair bonds and unshared pairs. That is, we usually do this. Sometimes it doesn't work, right? We do it, but when it doesn't work and we have to use more sophisticated orbitals, when we can't do it just on these pairs and shared pairs and lone pairs, when we have to get more sophisticated, you know what we say there is? we say there's resonance when we can't do it in such a simple way. Right? And then we can't just draw single Lewis structures of lines and so on. We have to take some mixture of them. So we're going to talk about that shortly, about how we recognize from the molecular orbital point of view why there's what resonance really is. Okay, so there's our set of electrons, the boron core. And now, from our point of view, we're not going to look at things that incorporate the whole basis set, that go over the whole molecule. We're just going to look at pairs of atoms. For example, we look at this pair that's formed from what? What are the two pieces, the two atomic orbitals that went into forming this pairwise orbital? Mike? So it's an sp something or other of boron. It's a hybrid orbital of boron. And you say sp2, and you're right. And 1s of h. Why did I draw the h bigger than the b orbital? This bonding combination of those two should be the very lowest in energy. Why isn't it 50-50? Why is it big on H, small on B? Brian? Hydrogen has... Does it have a bigger nuclear charge than boron? No. But what's its advantage? It uses 1s, where boron uses 2s, which means first that the orbital has a node, it's higher in energy for that, and also the core electrons are screening the boron, so it really has only 3, but it's at n equals 2. Right? So, hydrogen is lower in energy than boron, so the best combination of the two has hydrogen low, boron higher. The mixture looks more like hydrogen than it does like boron. Okay, so that's the sigma bonding orbital between boron and hydrogen. And its energy is intermediate between that lowest molecular orbital, or the lowest valence state molecular orbital, and the next pair. But there are 3 of these BH bonds, right? You can also do that one, and you can also do that one, and that's why Mike said it was sp2, so it makes 3 of them, right? And they all have the same energy in our point of view. But the neat thing is that the total energy from those 3 that we're guessing is the same as the total energy from the other 3, from the molecular orbital one. See what I'm saying? So what that means is that we're going to predict the right energy, right? If we use our model is going to be as good as the computer for purposes of getting the right energy, right? It's not inferior from that point of view. And it also turns out that it's the same for the point of view of total electron density. We're just slicing the same pie in different ways, okay? So we shouldn't feel inferior to the computer, and in fact we might feel superior because we have some understanding of why things are the way they are, rather than just following through some algorithm. Okay. Now, there are also the sigma star antibonds, and there are 3 of those, right? So for many purposes, these localized bond orbitals are not so bad, right? If we're trying to get the total energy, trying to get the total electron density, right? And they're much easier to think about. But beware of when there's resonance, when you have to go beyond individual pairs, when a single line in the Lewis structure doesn't make the grade. And also, this doesn't tell us about the property of individual electrons. Although we get the right total energy, we don't get the right energy for any one electron. Okay, for that, the molecular orbitals are better. Now, when might you care about the energy of an individual electron rather than just the energy of the molecule, which says how stable it is? Why might you care of the energy of one electron? Yeah, Matthew, pardon me? I couldn't hear.
Bonding.
It might enter into reactivity, but I think there's a much clearer example.
Maybe when you're dealing with a different molecule like CH2?
Maybe, but often you'd just be interested in the total stability of it. But there's some properties, David. When you change the energy of one electron with light to take a single electron from a bonding orbital to an antibonding orbital, right? That's just one electron moving. So you care about the energy of the one electron if you're trying to talk about interaction with light, for example. Or how much, what's the ionization potential of the molecule? That's taking out just one electron. So there you would want to know really what the energy of the individual electrons are. But if all you're interested in is the overall stability of the molecule, then our model's as good as the computer, although it's not quantitative in quite the same sense. Although, you'll see later on that you can do pretty darn well in making it quantitative. That'll come toward the end of the semester. Okay, so this localized bond orbital picture, sigma bonds, sigma star antibonds, pi bonds, pi star antibonds, and unshared orbitals, this is our intermediate between just looking at hydrogen-like atomic orbitals and looking at what a computer does and then what reality is. But when must we think more deeply than this? We got to think more deeply when localized orbitals mix with one another, either between two molecules, that's going to give rise to reactivity when orbitals mix with one another, or within a molecule when there's going to be resonance, and we'll talk about that. So where are we in our excursion through quantum mechanics? We started with atoms and saw that we could do a really good job with hydrogen-like atoms and hybridization. And then we found out this bad news about orbitals, that they're fundamentally wrong, but we could try to recover with various ways like self-consistent field or configuration interaction and so on. Then we went to molecules and looked at the united atom limit, the plum puddings, and then tried to understand bonds with pair wise linear combination of atomic orbitals and talked about energy match and overlap as determining the strength of bonds and how we could understand structure and dynamics of XH3 molecules through hybridization. And we looked at different ways of parsing, of dividing up the electron density in order to understand it. So now we're moving on to reactivity. And this will involve singly occupied molecular orbitals, SOMOs, high HOMOs, and low LUMOs. And it's what's going to tell us what a functional group is and how it will react. So that's the real payoff, and we're going to begin that now. Now, so it's going to come from mixing orbitals. Now, how many orbitals does a molecule have? Robin? An infinite number. So if we have an infinite number on molecule A and an infinite number of molecule B, and we're going to look at all the mixings, how many mixings are there going to be? Infinite squared, roughly. Over 2. Right? That helps us out. Okay, so there are all these orbitals on B, right? Only a few of which will be occupied, how many electrons we have in B. And those are occupied, and those are unoccupied, of which they're an infinite number if we go all the way up. And the same on A, and a certain number of occupied orbitals there. And now we're going to look at mixings of things. So we could look at the mixing of those two, for example. Or of those two, or 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 those two, blah, 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 blah. So there are lots. Okay? But what's going to save us? Why isn't this an infinite squared over 2 challenge? Because most of them we don't care about. They don't make any difference. So let's see which ones make a difference in changing the energy and in changing the electron distribution. Okay, so there are myriad possible pairwise mixings. Now, if they're unusual molecules that have an odd number of electrons, so there's a singly occupied molecular orbital on top, then it's quite clear that when you mix, as long as they can overlap, these singly occupied molecular orbitals, 2 electrons will go down, no electrons will go up. That's going to be great. It's going to make a bond. It's going to put electron density between those two and so on. It's just like H2 coming together, depending on how big the overlap is. So that's bound to be important if you have singly occupied molecular orbitals, right? 2 of them will react. Okay, but that's only important when they exist. And they're very rarely found. Why? Why do you rarely find, why can't you go and buy a bottle of radicals, as they're called? Mike? Because they do this. Right? So it's true of many atoms and these things called free radicals like CH3 dot, but you don't buy them in a bottle because they react with one another. They've already gone away, so you don't care about them unless you're interested in flames or explosions or something like that. Or chain reactions. We'll talk about those too. But generally, we're not going to encounter SOMOs, so we can forget those. Now, how about among the others? So they're not so common. Now, how about those? Do we care about that mixing? Maybe they have great overlap and go way up and down, like as shown. Do we care? Mayrov? There are no electrons to have the energy, so who cares? So that's already practically all of them, all the pairs disappear, because any vacant with vacant we don't care about, UMO with UMO. Okay, that's great. There's nothing there, so forget those. Now, how about down here, OMO with OMO? Now we care, right? Because it's changing the energy of electrons. Do we care? Dre? Because the antibonding goes up as much as the bonding goes down, makes no net difference. If you're interested in the energy of single electrons, then you care that the single electrons went up. It's going to be easier to pull out one of those electrons right when the two things are together. But if you don't care about that, single electron properties, then you're going to get roughly the same energy. And in fact, there's going to be a weak net repulsion because the up went up more than down went down. But that, you know, just balances. There's also correlation that draws heliums together at 50 angstroms from one another. So when you're at van der Waals distance between things that aren't reacting, that means that this correlation that's drawing things together is exactly balanced by this repulsion, this weak repulsion from the electrons that are there, so that's the energy minimum. You don't get closer or the repulsion would get too bad with bigger overlap. You don't get further because the correlation pulls it together, right? But anyhow, we don't care much about that. We don't care about that any more than we care about correlation. Okay. Now, how about here? Now we're mixing a vacant orbital with an occupied orbital, so two electrons go down. Okay? Do we care about this one? Do we care a lot about it? Why not a lot? Don?
Because they're so far apart.
Yeah, their energy match was bad. Right? So it didn't go down very far. So it's true, there's a little bit of stabilization, but it's not a lot. It's not a big deal. Okay, so there's negligible mixing and stabilization because the energy match was so bad. So what's left? What do we care about? We care about that one, right? And what is that the interaction between? The highest occupied molecular orbital and the lowest vacant molecular orbital. They might have enough, close enough energy match that it really makes a difference. So that's why there are names for HOMO and LUMO and not names for all these others, because those are the ones you care about. Now, of course, it's possible that there would be two that are very near HOMO, right, and both of them could do it, and two near the same energy for LUMO. So there could be a few others involved, but not very many. There are very few of these that we're going to have to consider that are really going to make a difference. Okay, and that's going to give rise to bonding between A and B and a reaction. Okay, but it's not any old, there's always a HOMO, right? Only H plus doesn't have a HOMO, right, because there are no electrons. So everything's got a HOMO, everything's got a LUMO, right? But not everything is a functional group, not everything is reactive. Because it has to be that the HOMO is sort of unusually high and the LUMO is sort of unusually low in order for there to be good energy match. Right? Because normal HOMOs and LUMOs aren't high enough or low enough to get good energy match. So they're going to have to be unusual. And you know what we call something that has an unusually high HOMO? A base. And can you guess what we call something that has an unusually low LUMO? An acid. Okay, so most mixing of molecular orbitals affects neither the overall energy nor the overall electron distribution for one or more of these reasons that we just discussed. The electron occupancy among these orbitals is either 4, they're both occupied, or 0, they're both vacant. Then we don't care, as we just discussed. Second, there may be very poor energy match between the two. Then we don't care, because you're not going, the best combination is just the better one. There may be poor overlap, in which case you don't get anything to shift when things are really far away, or when they're close together, but oriented so they're orthogonal and that there's no net overlap. But if you have high HOMO, low LUMO mixing, that constitutes reactivity. Right? So we could look at the evolution, and we'll do some more of this kind of thing soon, of acid-base theories through the years. Lavoisier, 220 years ago, said that an acid was an oxidized substance, and a base was a substance waiting to be oxidized. We'll talk about this some more and you'll understand it then. 100 years later, Arrhenius, who had the idea that things can come apart into ions, reinterpreted the concepts of acid and base in terms of an acid being something that could give up H+, and a base being something that was a source of OH-. Right? And 35 years later, Brunsted in Denmark and Lowry in England proposed, yes, that an acid is an H+ donor, but a base is not just something that gives OH-, it's anything that can accept a proton. So it made it the concept more general than just something that gave OH-. So now ammonia, for example, can be a base. Right? And in that, so the progress in science is generally associated with increasing generality. At first you catalog specific things, and then you begin to notice generalities. So this idea that an H+ acceptor is more general as a definition of a base than an OH- source is an example of increasing generality. But also in 1923, Lewis proposed that an acid is not just an H+ donor, but anything that can accept an electron pair, a thing that others called an electrophile, and that a base was anything that could donate an electron pair, also called a nucleophile. And then in the 1960s, this idea of HOMO-LUMO came along, and it got generalized even further. So now, something with an unusually low LUMO is something that it can accept electrons into it, right? So that's an acid, and something with an unusually high HOMO is a base. Now, there's a key word here. You see what it is?
Unusually.
Right? And what do you ask? Right.
Yes.
Okay, so what makes something reactive? How do you recognize that something is going to be an acid or a base? What makes it unusual in its being a low LUMO or high HOMO? Because everything has a highest occupied and the lowest vacant. So what's unusual? Well, first we have to decide what's usual. So in organic chemistry, we're mostly dealing with carbon-hydrogen, carbon-carbon bonds. And it just by chance, the carbon-hydrogen bond, the orbitals that come together, have about the same energy. Carbon has a bigger nuclear charge, but it's using 2s and 2p. Hydrogen's using 1s, and they come out to be about the same. So they mix pretty much 50-50, and you get sigma and sigma star bonds. Sigma star bonds, sigma star antibonds. Okay, and these are bread and butter every day. These are usual. Okay, so we're going to define those energies for our purposes as usual. So anything that has any orbital that has a lot higher energy occupied orbital than a CH bond or a CC bond, it's the same deal. Anything that has much higher is going to be an acid. Anything it's going to be a base. Anything that's got much lower than that sigma star LUMO is going to be an acid. Okay, now what factors enter into this to make things have these unusual energies? What are the sources of their weirdness? The first one is that there can be valence shell atomic orbitals which never mixed with anything. So they didn't go up and down the way hydrogen and carbon did here. So they're in the middle. And if they have electrons, they'll be unusually high. If they're vacant, they're unusually low. Second, you can have not such good overlap as you have here. So this doesn't go down as far, and that one doesn't go up as far. That would make them unusual. Third, you could have the pieces that are coming together, the atomic orbitals that are doing the mixing, are themselves unusually high or unusually low because of what nuclear charge they have or what N, you know, what quantum level is being considered. And finally, presence of electric charge obviously has to do with the energies of electrons. So if you have positive charge around, it makes orbitals low in energy. If you have negative charge around, it makes orbitals high in energy. Okay, so let's go through these. Okay, first, unmixed valence shell atomic orbitals. Okay, so H+, there's the acid already with Arrhenius, right? And it's an unusually low LUMO, right? Because it never mixed with anything. So it's got no electrons in it, but it's not anything like as high as sigma star because it never mixed with anything. Okay, that's a good one. Or NH3. Now, wait a second. I thought nitrogen has a big nuclear charge compared to carbon, right? So it's going to make electrons unusually stable, the higher nuclear charge compared to carbon. How can I say that these are unusually high rather than unusually low because of the nuclear charge? Compared to what? Right? They're certainly low compared to where you started with carbon because of the bigger nuclear charge. But that's not what we're comparing with. What are we comparing with? This, right, is our standard. So why is it high compared to this? Even though it starts low, right, with the nuclear charge. Why is it unusually high occupied orbital? Because it didn't mix with anything and get sent down, right? It's an unshared pair. Okay, so that's going to make NH3 a base. It's an unusually high HOMO. Now, BH3 is the mirror image of that, right? Boron has a small nuclear charge compared to carbon, one less proton. That would tend to make the orbitals high in energy. But I'm saying this is unusually low. Why is it unusually low compared to our standards? Because it didn't mix with something and go up. Right, it's a vacant atomic orbital. It's not like an antibond. So it's unusually low. Okay? Now, how about water? The unshared pair on water. Right? It's like ammonia in being an unshared pair, didn't get shifted down. But it started low because of the extra proton in the oxygen nucleus. So it's not as basic as ammonia is. It's not as high in energy as the unshared pair in ammonia because of the bigger nuclear charge. Or if we changed it not to be water, but to be OH minus, right? Now it's higher in energy. Why? Why are these electrons higher in energy, an unusually high HOMO? Obviously that's a base compared to this. It's the same electrons, yeah? Right. Extra negative charge around makes electrons unhappy. They're high in energy. Okay? And that, notice, also was a factor here with H+. Or we could take CH3 minus, which is of course the same C we had here, right? But it's even higher in energy. At first it didn't mix. And then it's even higher in energy because of these charges, right? So the charge is another factor in determining whether things are unusual. Okay. Now we can look at these acids and bases reacting with one another, and remember that we draw curved arrows to show shifts of electrons. Curved arrows don't show motion of nuclei. they show curved, the curved arrows show how electrons shift. Okay, so you start the arrow wherever the electron pair you're talking about is in the starting material, and you end the arrow, the point of the arrow, where that electron pair is in the product, in this case, halfway between O and H, or anyhow, between them. Okay? Now, we can do exactly this, the reaction of ammonia with H plus is exactly the same reaction. High HOMO shifts into the middle to make a bond. And now we got a positive charge on the nitrogen. And we could use it with another, so we used a different base in that case. Now we're using a different acid, BH3, with its low vacant orbital, but exactly the same process to give that. So see the generality of this acid-base concept. Right? Or we can use neither H plus nor OH minus, but do exactly the same reaction. Okay, so these are all acid-base reactions, high HOMO with low LUMO. Now, the second reason you can have unusual energies is because the overlap isn't good. Can you think of an example? What, you know what I'm going to show? Two orbitals on atoms that overlap, but not very well. Yeah. If they were orthogonal, they wouldn't overlap at all. That's the limit of it. But I want a case where they really do overlap, just not as good as these sigma things that we're comparing to. Matt? Matthew, do you have any? What? No? Aviva? The double bond, the pia orbitals don't overlap as well as these do, right? So when we have a pi orbitals like this, they don't. We start more or less the same place with two carbon p orbitals, a little bit higher because they're not hybridized, right? But roughly the same. But they don't mix very much, so they don't go down. So now you have an unusually high HOMO and an unusually low LUMO. But you might say that the high HOMO is a little more high than the low LUMO is low, if you wanted to just pick one, right? Because they started a little higher. So that has an unusually high HOMO. So we're going to expect to see C double bond C be a functional group. Is it going to be a base or an acid? Well, it's going to be both. It has both a low LUMO and a high HOMO, but especially the high HOMO. So it's going to be especially reactive with acids, probably. Okay? Or we can now make the two atoms different, right? P of carbon and P of oxygen. And oxygen is lower. So now, which one of these is most unusual? Brian? Is it pi or pi star that's most unusual? The antibonding. Why? Because the O started so low that it didn't go up very much from carbon, right? So it's really unusually low. The occupied orbital is also a little bit high, but not as high. And notice, incidentally, that these energies are qualitative. I don't have exact numbers here. I'm just talking about the principles that are involved. Okay, so the low LUMO, that's going to be an acid. And it'll react with bases. Or another reason you can have bad overlap is because the hybrids don't point at each other. They're distorted, as we saw in this pathological bonding in that three-membered ring. Right? Those are going to be very reactive. Okay, or the third case is that the atomic orbitals that go into the molecular orbital are unusual. We already saw that. Where did we see it? Just the previous slide, when we mixed carbon with oxygen, the oxygen started down low, so the mixture didn't go up very much for the LUMO. Okay? But to have other examples with sigma bonds, suppose you have a carbon fluorine or a carbon other halogen bond, right? Then the sigma star is going to be unusually low because it didn't mix very much. The carbon doesn't go up as much as it does in sigma star CH. So those are going to be unusually low orbitals and will react with bases. Right? Yeah, energy mismatch, right. And notice, again, it's all compared to what? Because we deal mostly with organic chemistry, CC and CH bonds are our standard, and the antibonds are our standard for LUMOs. right? But in these cases where you have something other than carbon or hydrogen, it's different. So if you had, for example, a bond between hydrogen and lithium, or carbon and lithium, something that's way to the left of the periodic table, doesn't have such a big nuclear charge, that's going to be just the flip side of this thing with halogens that are far to the right. So now we're going to have unusually high occupied orbitals, because the boron, in this case, with not so many protons in it, doesn't mix so much with the hydrogen. So there we have an unusually high HOMO. So BH3 will be an acid or a base? What does it say? Unusually high HOMO, it's going to be a base. So BH3 is a base. Oh, wait a second. Is BH3 an acid or a base? Because in the first slide, I said it was an acid. Right? It's an acid because it had that vacant p orbital that hadn't mixed with anything. That was on the first slide. And now I'm telling you that it's a base because it has an unusually high HOMO, that sigma bond. What does that suggest? Andrew? It's both. So it's both. So what? Jordan? It's not such a very strong acid or base, although it's not chopped liver, yeah? It'll react with itself. So we can take two of these. It can't react within the same molecule. Why can't the p orbital, that's an unusually low vacant orbital, and the sigma orbital, an unusually high occupied orbital, why don't they just mix with one another? They're orthogonal. But if you take two molecules and bring them together, then you can get overlap. So here this one comes up, and its p orbital overlaps with this, right? So you get extra electron density in here, and it's bonding. And in fact, notice, it's bonding among all three atoms. It's not just holding two atoms together, it's holding three atoms together. Those electrons are shared among three atoms, right? So we could draw a bond that's like, this is popular at Yale, right? It's a Y bond. Instead of a line, it's a Y. So it's two electrons bonding three centers together, right? Okay, but now there's also this LUMO that we didn't use, and there's this HOMO that we didn't use. So what? So those can mix too, and we can make a second Y bond. Okay? Or we could draw it this way. So that's the structure of B2H6. And you remember earlier on in lecture 2, when we were doing Lewis structures, we said, how could it be that BH3 dimerizes to give B2H6? This is how. Right, it forms two of these Y bonds. Okay, here's a true or false question. Low energy MOs create bonding. Is that right? Fair enough? Kevin, pardon me? Compared to what? Right? That's not true. What's true is that lowered energy MOs cause bonding. If you start at a certain place and they get lower, that's bonding. You don't care in absolute terms how low they are. You care how low they are compared to where they started. So it's when it gets lowered that you get a bond. Okay, it's a question of compared to what? It's compared to its separated components. Okay, now we're going to talk about HOMO-LUMO mixing for reactivity and for understanding what we mean by resonance. So reactivity is between molecules, just as we saw in forming B2H6 here. But resonance is something different. Resonance is within a molecule. Like we were thinking of BH3, whether it could stabilize itself by mixing its low LUMO with its high HOMO, and it couldn't because they were orthogonal, right? But suppose that they weren't orthogonal. You could imagine a molecule that had a low LUMO and a high HOMO when we made our analysis, but they weren't like perpendicular to one another, right? Then they would mix, right? And so that is to say, between localized orbitals whose overlap we had overlooked at first glance, that is, we went through and we made our bonds and we found vacant orbitals and unshared pairs in our analysis, but we hadn't taken into account yet that a high HOMO could overlap a low LUMO within the molecule. Then the molecule has a way of getting more stable than we gave it credit for, right? And that's what resonance is. When the first Lewis type of structure you draw, when you draw just bonds, right, and put unshared pairs and things like that, so you've done this localized analysis just between pairs and isolated atoms, right? When you make that analysis, but don't think that there might be possibilities for further stabilization by mixing those things, that's when resonance occurs and you have to draw more than one Lewis structure. And we'll talk more about this. And that's all I was going to say. I was hoping that Tom Stites was going to appear to accept your applause, but he's got other things going on, so he'll come and talk to you sometime about what he did, I think. If you can't get that out of a former roommate, I don't know what you can do. Are there any questions about this stuff? I went through it pretty fast. Yeah, Sharif? Speak up a bit.
What happens when the molecule is an acid in a base like NH3 and it goes to NH2 minus NH4 plus?
Okay, I've kept you over 2 minutes many times, so I'll let you go 2 minutes early this time. You can get the bus and so on. But if you have questions, come on up.
I think it's called when it's amphoteric or amphiproteic, right?
Yeah, amphoteric is a thing that was thought up in terms of proton transfer, right? That water can either give up a proton or accept a proton. People don't use that term so much in this most general analysis where you're talking about HOMOs and LUMOs. Usually that just relates to accepting and giving a proton, so the older style. But conceptually, it's the same thing, that BH3 could be considered amphoteric because it's both a base and an acid.
So I was just looking at NH3 example you're given in that slide where you showed us the energy.
Yeah.
And then you showed how NH3 became NH4 plus.
Yeah.
I was wondering how it also became NH2 minus.
Well, it's not so good. It's a pretty strong bond, and the electronegativity difference or the nuclear charge isn't so big between nitrogen and hydrogen as it is between fluorine and hydrogen. Right? So it's easier for fluorine with hydrogen to lose a hydrogen, a proton, to be an acid, than it is for NH to do that.
Right.
NH isn't such a good acid. But it is an acid. It has a pKa of 35, I think, where water is 16. Right? So it's 20 powers of 10 weaker, but it can be both an acid and a base. And if you need, often, organic chemists who need a really strong base to pull a proton off something that isn't a very good acid, they often use nitrogen anions like that.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, Mirav?
Just about the first reason for getting HOMOs and LUMOs was that you have unmixed valence shells. So before two molecules bond, don't they all have unmixed?
Oh yeah, but most of them have mixed then. So we do our...
How have they mixed?
Right. Well, let's get back to the slide here and we'll look at it. Just a second. I got to... I'll save that. And we'll look at that. Which is where? Here. This is the one?
Right, yeah.
So you can have... the things we're comparing to are things where two neighbors came together and mixed, and you got this not high, not very high HOMO and not very low LUMO.
Right.
Okay. Now, if you have just H+ as a reagent, right, it hasn't done this trick. It hasn't come with anything else. So if you have it around, it's an unusually low vacant orbital compared to this.
Okay.
Once you react it with something, once you react, one will go up here and one will go down here. Then there's nothing unusual. Right, but you might be considering H plus, not some other
thing. Only like all of these. Before,
right, it's unmixed valence shell atomic orbitals, or the p orbital on BH3 is of the same sort.
Okay.
BH3 is a perfectly good molecule, but it has that vacant orbital that's unusually low in energy.
Okay. So
and NH3 has.
So like this. every molecule that hasn't bonded yet.
Yeah.
Has unmixed valence shells.
Yeah, but it may have these have bonded. These have bonded, right? BH3 has formed three bonds, NH3 has formed three bonds, water has formed two bonds, but there still are unshared pairs there.
Okay.
And those haven't gone up and down. So it's the unmixed valence shell atomic orbitals.
Okay.
So the vacant orbital here is still an atomic orbital. It's not a molecular orbital.
Okay.
And the unshared pair here is some hybrid orbital of nitrogen. It's not an NH mixture.
Oh, okay. That's
yeah. Good.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Just for you, one is do you know when your series of lectures is going to go online?
It's going to be late this month.
All right, because I was talking to my high school AP Chem teacher.
Yeah.
And she really wants to see some of your stuff.
Okay, it'll be on late this month, I think.
Very cool. And tonight we're seeing you 5:30, right?
5:30. Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
I didn't understand the Y bond and why necessarily that occurs.
Yeah. Okay. So you get a bond when you mix a high HOMO with a low LUMO,
mm-hmm.
right? Or atomic orbitals.
Okay.
Same thing. Okay. So that orbital that mixes may not be on an atom. It may be between two atoms.
Okay.
It's still if it's unusually high, and if you can overlap with it,
okay.
those electrons can be more stable. So those electrons that were in the BH bond, they spend more of their time on H than on B, but they're on both.
Okay.
Right? And that's an unusually high because boron is one of the components, which is a high atomic orbital. So there's an unusually high pair. Usually we're talking about an unshared pair or something like that, but here's a bond that's unusually high. Now you bring in a vacant orbital, and those two mix, and you get a mixture that goes down in energy and one that goes up in energy.
Okay.
But the electrons now are shared with this, but they were already shared with these two. So these electrons are shared among three atoms.
Okay.
So it's a bond that holds all three together.
Yeah, it's just the idea of like a three-way bond is pretty new to me.
Yeah.
So
it was entirely new about 40 or 50 years ago.
Yeah.
And it still is not talked about a whole lot in textbooks, but there's nothing special about it.
It's just another way for like a bond to form, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it doesn't happen so very often, because there are not so many cases where you have unusually high electrons in a bond and an unusually low vacant orbital that's able to stabilize them. So BH3 is such a case.
Okay.
But there are others that we'll see, too.
All right, thanks.
Yeah.